Our true crime podcast deals with sensitive issues, including some that little ears shouldn't hear. Listener discretion is advised.
This is Cam.
And I'm Jen.
And you're listening to
Our True Crime Podcast.
Hey everyone, this is Sarah from Good Nightmare Podcast, a podcast where I like to talk about all things strange and unusual, whether it's mysteries, historical crimes, or fairy tale origins. I hope you'll come along for the ride and join me as we delve into some spooky tales. Happy listening.
Hey, true crime fans, check out our new podcast, I Said Goddamn. We're a true crime comedy podcast hosted by two besties who like to share messed up cases that make you say goddamn. Each week, we try to one-up each other's story by sharing a horrific case the other has never heard of. Along the way, we splash in some wildly inappropriate jokes and colorful language. Listen every Sunday from any of your favorite podcast directories and follow us on Twitter at ISGDPodcast or visit our website, ISGDPodcast.com.
Hey, Jen.
Hey, Cam. How are you?
I'm fantabuloso.
Yeah, what's going on? Anything?
It's cold outside and I love it.
I know, it's great. I noticed you had your CrimeCon sweatshirt on.
I do.
CrimeCon. CrimeCon, we love CrimeCon. Anybody else going out there this year to New Orleans?
Oh, look at the room. Yeah, everybody's raising their hand.
Talking to our friends out there in podcast land.
I just thought it was weird to ask a question like that when it's really just me and you and the dog, but okay.
You didn't watch enough Mr. Rogers as a kid.
I did not.
Land of make-believe.
I guess I did not.
Mm-hmm.
Explains a lot about you.
Anyway. If you haven't signed up for CrimeCon, it's in June. I think the first week in June.
Maybe it's
first,
like 7, 8, 9.
Yeah, something like that. It's in New Orleans.
New Orleans.
And Camille and I will be there. And if you are going, hit us up and maybe we could like
I'll
meet for
out.
Drinks or something. That would be fun. We'd love to meet you.
Etouffee.
Etouffee.
A little etouffee.
Little beignet.
Little beignon.
Yeah, I can't have that chicory coffee though.
Bleh. I don't like coffee either.
Yeah.
So anyway, yes, it would be great.
We would love to hang out with people. Love to see you there.
Yes.
Anyway, other than that, nothing's going on my side. Anyway, what do you have?
Oh, Jen.
I'm excited. Your last one with the co-ed killer was absolutely fantastic. Well, as much as a story of
murder can be.
Right. But it's so sad to get excited about serial killers.
It's not excited, really. It's okay, so here's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
We had mentioned this in that episode, too. To me, it is interesting to see what drives these people, to
right.
see why they do it, to
mm-hmm.
see what their hangups are that lead to this.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fascinating. I like the mind of it, the mind,
right.
you know, not the killing and all of that, but like what's going on? Like, I have so many questions.
And do you think we as women, since we usually are the victims of serial
often.
Killers, often, more often than not,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We just kind of like to hear what dangers?
I wouldn't say dangers. I would just say that, I don't know. I just think, I don't know. I've been fascinated, intrigued with this my whole
forever.
Life.
Forever. Yeah. So, I mean, same I here. I mean, the first time I heard about Charles Manson, I was hooked. Helter
right.
Skelter movie.
Other thing, couple mm-hmm. things real quick. You know, I always struggle with how much is too much, how
mm-hmm.
much is too, what is too graphic?
Right.
What do I include? What do I not?
And it's hard.
This is pretty graphic.
Okay.
This killer.
So we need a double.
It's just graphic. But then again, I think all murder is graphic.
Right.
Sometimes I choose to leave things out because I don't think it's important. Other times I put things in because I think it leads to you as the listener or the person that's hearing this, you get to find out about this particular killer and how
deep
they,
into the personal hell they.
Yeah, and just like how they morph, they continue, they grow, they change, and how they get good at what they do and what they change and how and, you
right.
know, all
mm-hmm.
of that. And that's exactly how this case.
How he accelerates and becomes
confident in what he's doing.
Gotcha.
Another thing to discuss, because I think I'm pretty sure this is the first case that we've had. Both you and I have always agreed that all lives matter. It doesn't matter if you're a drug addict. It doesn't matter if you're a child. It doesn't matter if you're an elderly person. It
doesn't matter if you're a dog or a cat.
It's all, everything matters, right? Yeah. Everything that lives and breathes matters.
Exactly.
This case, this story, these crimes, they're all prostitutes, okay?
Sex workers.
Which, you know, as a teacher, I'm sorry, sex workers. As a teacher, I have the older kids, and I can always see the little kids in them. And right. So, like, that's what I think about. Like, when you see a 23-year-old drug addict, you know they were somebody's child. They were somebody's baby girl that climbed on her daddy's lap and just sang at one time was a kid, you know? And I see that. So, to me, it's just as important as every other case. And I know that there are certain podcasts, who shall remain nameless, that has caught some grief. You know, that they profile missing persons or a murdered person that was a prostitute or a drug addict. And somehow other people think that that's not worthy of the attention. No. And I know that you and I both disagree, right?
Exactly. I mean, they are probably the ones that I have the most compassion for, because they are the ones that were lost.
Yes.
Mentally and
before, everything.
Right.
Right.
Before they actually became physically lost.
Right.
And my soul aches for them.
Yeah. And we all know you don't wake up one day and become a drug addict.
Or like
there's
homeless,
there's things that lead to
or,
that.
Right. And most people that...
Okay, I'll get off my soapbox.
Well, I mean, for me, I deal with depression. I totally understand. I've never been addicted to drugs or anything like that. But I understand how that happens. And I understand the holes that you go through. And I understand that some people self-medicate, and horrible that people take advantage and go after those, use them. And
we'll discuss that. We'll talk about that a little bit in this case.
It's horrible, but you're right. Every life matters and everybody
counts.
Yes.
Amen. Okay. You ready?
And I have no problem with prostitution. Honestly, I think they should legalize it.
It's because you're too ugly. Nobody would pay for it.
Oh,
it's not prostitution. It's sex working.
It's sex.
Remember?
What you got?
So it was October 30th, 1986, when a man searching the area for aluminum cans noticed something in a drainage ditch. Of course, right?
And it wasn't a mannequin.
As the man got closer, he could see that it was not a mannequin, but the body of a young woman. The woman was lying on her back and her clothes were all ripped up. She was covered in blood. He immediately ran to get help. It's never a mannequin, except for in that one case with the co-ed killer, it was a mannequin that one time.
But it was a setup mannequin, yeah.
The body turned out to later be identified as 23-year-old Michelle Yvette Gutierrez, a former resident of Corpus Christi, Texas. The autopsy provided some graphic details and unveiled a horrible death. Gutierrez suffered severe mutilation and trauma to the anal and vaginal areas. Stab wounds covered her face, chest, and buttocks. Ligature marks on her neck suggested that she had been strangled as the gruesome mutilations were taking place. There were very few clues left, but...
So he was strangling her and...
Mutilating her at the same time, yes. But sadly, it wouldn't be long before the Southern California murderer would again come calling.
Wow. Good entry. Another dateline.
It was on December 11th that authorities were called yet again to another homicide. Okay, so this is not even quite 2 months later. 24-year-old Charlotte Jean Palmer was a transient from Anna, Illinois. Her badly decomposed body was discovered near Highway 74 in Romoland, which is approximately 25 miles from the Gutierrez dump site. And I hate to say dump site, but there's a reason, because that's exactly what this mad killer did. It's disgusting. Since her body was so badly decomposed, the coroner could not even be positive of her cause of death. Also, at this time, they were unaware that these two were related.
25 miles apart, yeah.
Right. In January of 1997, a naked and badly mutilated body was discovered along a dirt road in Lake Elsinore. I've been to Lake Elsinore.
Yeah.
Very cute. Yeah.
It's cute?
Yeah, it's cute. It's a little suburb.
Okay.
It was determined that the victim had been dead for at least 3 days with high amounts of alcohol and cocaine in the system. The woman was Linda Ann Ortega, a 37-year-old part-time fast food worker with the rap sheet for drugs and prostitution. Mm. It was at this point that investigators could not ignore the fact they thought they might have a serial killer on their hands. Riverside is down in that area. California's huge, as we all know.
Really?
Yeah. I'm giving you some geography lessons here, Jen. Mm-hmm. Unlike St. Louis, where St. Louis is the city and then you have all these suburbs and not that many people live in the city per se. I mean, right. They do, but it's, you know.
Most of it.
California is just like one giant town. I mean, there's, you know, citrus fields and things like that in between, but like right.
Well,
Riverside.
From downtown St. Louis to the furthest suburb is over an hour drive.
Yeah. And this is nothing. Like, right. It just goes on and on and on. I digress.
It's all LA, right?
Yeah, Riverside's like, oh my God. It like just goes on and on and on. And mm-hmm. Anyway.
That's different from Riverdale, correct?
Yes, correct. Okay. As investigators were called to the fourth homicide location, any hope of it being a different killer was soon squashed. The similarities were too striking to ignore and too graphic to be random. It was on May 2nd, 1987, that a 27-year-old named Martha Bess Young was discovered in a ravine not far from the Ortega murder site. Young, who was originally from Albuquerque, New Mexico, was discovered, this is graphic, posed in a fully naked spread eagle position.
Oh.
She, too, had a rap sheet for prostitution and drugs, okay? There were drugs found in her blood as well. The county coroner later determined she had been dead for approximately 3 weeks and died from a lethal dose of amphetamines as she was being strangled.
Huh. So he's getting them off the streets with...
his piece of work. Mm. It's just, this list goes on and on. And this, writing this, I had a hard time because I was like, it's so confusing. Like, I had to go make sure I... You know what I mean?
Right. Because he's killing them differently.
On and on.
I mean, there's still strangulation, but it seems like there's...
He's getting braver.
Right.
Is what's happening. The police were quick to act and formed a task force to uncover this dark monster. The task force was headed by Riverside Police Chief Linford L. Richardson, Sheriff's Lieutenant Al Hearn, Captain Bill Reynolds, Lieutenant William H. Caldwell, and Sheriff Coles Byrd, among others.
Wow.
The officers were each given 14 detectives under them, assist them in their quest to get this. This was, at this time, this was
huge.
The largest enforcement effort ever assembled in Riverside County. Now, here's where I plug one of my favorite TV shows, mm-hmm. people out there in La La Land. It's called Real Detective, and in it, the investigator Bob Creed discusses his work on the case. The show is raw. It's emotional. Makes me love police officers even more than I already do. Okay?
I
have a little crush on Bob.
Really?
Yeah, kind of.
I'll have to watch it.
He's cute.
You think everybody's cute, though.
I do. So the murders and the publicity surrounding this were starting to gain a lot of press and attention. So
I would think so, yeah.
So the killer...
And honestly, that's good, because remember the last case where all the mm-hmm. blood on the bayou, homeless and whatever, they weren't getting any media attention. Right.
So the killer stopped killing, or he chose a different location to dump bodies. And the answer to that, we still don't know today. 2 years passed, but on January 27th, 1989, he struck again. A 37-year-old prostitute named Linda Mae Rez was discovered on the beach of Lake Elsinore. Again, she had had alcohol and drugs in her system. Her face was buried in the sand, and the autopsy later revealed that sand was found in her throat, and the cause of death was acute asphyxiation. Nearly 6 months later, on June 28, 1989, the body of 28-year-old Kimberly Lytle was discovered in Cottonwood Canyon. Lytle was a known prostitute and drug user. The official cause of death was listed as asphyxiation, but this one was a little bit different. Police learned that several pubic hairs and fibers unrelated to the victim herself were discovered on the body.
Huh.
So we're getting some evidence.
But she was a sex worker, right?
Mm-hmm, she was.
So, okay. Mm-hmm. That's some evidence, but they don't know for sure.
Not yet. The news was starting to get around, and this quiet community would soon be annoyed with reporters from out of town flying in to cover the murders. The murderer was dubbed the Riverside Prostitute Killer, or the Lake Elsinore Killer. Not even 6 months later, another mutilated body would be discovered just northwest of Lake Elsinore. On November 11th, 1989, the body of 36-year-old Judy Lynn Angel. Angel had a long rap sheet, which included arrest for prostitution and drugs. During the autopsy, the coroner discovered several deep gashes on the woman's hands. Mm. The injuries appeared to be defensive wounds, which meant she had tried to fend off her attacker. The victim also suffered several blows to the face, which ultimately crushed her cranium.
Oh.
So, Jen, as Facebook detectives, we got that degree from Facebook.
Of course.
And Netflix, right?
Dateline, 48 hours.
We know that prostitutes are often chosen as victims.
They're easy.
Because they easily get into a stranger's car and travel with the man away from a location which we all know is a terrible thing to do. They are often also drug addicts or runaways, mm-hmm. and they also move around a lot. So it takes a while for anyone to notice they're missing.
Right.
Simply put, they're easy targets to prey
on. They are.
On December 13th, 1989, a month after the discovery of Judy Lynn Angel's remains, the body of 23-year-old Christina Leal was found in Quail Valley. Now, this murder was different, or so it first appeared. Leal was fully clothed and did not appear to have suffered serious abuse or mutilation prior to death, much like the other ones. Something else was left behind, too. The killer left tire tracks, which made a deep impression into the ground. Since the other victim had appeared to try to fight her attacker, this victim's hands were encased in paper bags to preserve anything that might be under the nails, such as fibers, hands, and other evidence.
The police did that.
So the question as to why the victim was dressed was about to be answered. The autopsy revealed that the victim had, in fact, been stabbed directly in the heart. Due to the victim's clothing, the wound was not immediately noticeable, which means the killer had dressed her after he murdered her. Yes.
Wow.
The knife wound, while potentially fatal, was not the immediate cause of death. The victim died as a result of asphyxiation by strangulation. Authorities found something else. Several pubic hairs and fibers were again found on the body, and these matched the ones discovered on Kimberly Lytle. It was the next discovery that leaves you saying, well, leaves me saying, WTF. Inside her genital area, the killer had shoved a light bulb up inside her. Now, the kind of light bulb this was sort of a rare light bulb.
Was it one of the Edison bulbs?
It was a long one. I don't know. Authorities... Shut up, Jen. I hate... I'm trying to be all scientific here, and you're just ruining my vibe. Also, the authorities knew that it took a lot of care and a lot of time and a lot of precision to get that in there without breaking it.
Oh, well, yeah.
So he had some time with her.
Right.
Okay. So with this perverse, grim calling card, police knew that this killer was getting comfortable and the deaths would be escalating. They needed more evidence if they were going to get this guy. But unfortunately, they did not have one single suspect. It wouldn't be too long before he struck again. January 18th, 1990, a man who was out for a jog stumbled upon the body of 24-year-old prostitute named Darla Jean Ferguson.
Once again,
she was strangled, and the brutality was so severe, she severed most of her tongue during the attack. Again, the killer left tire tracks at the scene. Oh, she severed almost all of it. It was barely hanging on.
Wow.
February 8th, 1990, farmers working in a field discovered the nude body of 35-year-old Carol Lynn Miller. The cause of death was listed as multiple stab wounds to the chest as well as asphyxiation. The coroner also made note of a wound near Carol's right nipple. Pubic hairs were discovered on the victim, which again were matched to the ones found on the previous two victims.
Wow. So he's like not too bright then if he's leaving the stuff there.
You idiot. The killer's most brutal crime was about to be uncovered. A man who was working at an industrial plant in Northeast Riverside noticed something strange. It was a mound of branches that looked as if they were placed there, as if they didn't belong there.
Right.
So under the branches was the naked, mutilated body of 33-year-old Cheryl Coker. Coker, like the previous victims, was a drug user and a prostitute. Her body was badly mangled. Her right breast had been removed and placed next to her body. She died as a result of strangulation. Now, it was at this location that the police found shoe prints that belonged to a tennis shoe, and they believe that to be
I wonder why he decided to cover up the body this time and not the other times.
The evidence was starting to gather, and it was only a matter of time before the police would get the break they needed, but not soon enough. On December 21st, 1990, a janitor was emptying dustbins at a factory complex on Iowa Avenue when he discovered the nude and carefully posed body of a young woman. Investigators on the scene recognized the victim as 27-year-old Susan Sternfield. She was a local prostitute. Mm-hmm. Now, unlike the others before, there was no evidence of mutilation found on the victim's remains, and the county coroner later determined she died of strangulation. I'm going to guess here maybe he ran out of time or something and didn't get to do what he
wanted. But he posed her.
He did. We soon have victim number 13. Do you believe that? We're up to 13.
Unreal.
42-year-old Kathleen Leslie Milne. She was discovered on January 19, 1991, as a motorist spotted her body alongside the road west of Lake Elsinore. According to the autopsy report, the victim was rendered unconscious by several blows to the head and then strangled. She had been dead less than 24 hours.
But he just left her right out in the open.
Sure did.
Like right by the side of the road. And how did she die again?
Strangled.
So he just strangled her and threw her out of the car.
Yep, just like trash. He's a piece of trash.
He is a piece of trash.
The community was getting very discouraged as the police were not getting closer to apprehending him. As the case was gathering more and more attention, it hit the national news outlets, as well as being featured on America's Most Wanted.
Huh.
Still didn't break the case.
John Walsh.
We still have several more to go. I met John Walsh. He was nice.
Was he?
Yeah,
he seems nice.
Law enforcement personnel kicked it up the heat and began patrolling the areas. Now, all this attention didn't faze the killer. He just kept going, kept working, kept eluding police. I mean, you'd think he'd take a break. Nope. It was April 27th, 1991, that the body of 24-year-old Sherry Michelle Pazer, a part-time maid and prostitute, was found in a bowling alley, the Lower Bed. Could you imagine explaining that to the kids?
Oh.
But it gets worse. She'd been strangled and posed, and yet, with another grotesque calling card of sorts left behind, she had a toilet plunger inserted inside her and was left protruding from her.
So he,
Bowling alley! Flower bed! People are around!
Mm.
On July 4th, 1991, now could you explain this one?
Uh-uh.
To your kids. Picnickers, out for a picnic, were near Railroad Canyon Road, discovered the remains of 37-year-old Sherry Ann Latham. This is victim 15. She was found in a citrus orchard.
Hmm.
The victim's hand was wrapped around some nearby branches, suggesting that she was still alive when the killer left. There were grapefruit peelings near the body, along with partially eaten grapefruit. This suggests the killer took his time, wasn't stressed or anything about, you know, taking human life, so he thought he'd just have his little snack.
He watched her die. I bet you he watched her die.
Unbelievable. Authorities believe Latham had made one last attempt to try to crawl away before succumbing to her injuries. An autopsy later revealed that the victim had been strangled. Yet another clue was left behind. Cat hair? Cat fur? Because cats have fur, right? Not hair.
Yeah, cats ever.
Was found on the body of Latham, yet Latham did not own a cat. Finally, investigators got a break. In August of 1991, a witness claimed seeing a man driving a gray van picked up a prostitute near the University of California. They tracked down the prostitute, and she told investigators that everything was going fine at first, but then this John became angry and began assaulting her for no reason. The woman was creeped out and managed to jump out of the vehicle and run down the street.
Good for her.
This is really sad. The man quickly sped off, but stopped at a nearby corner. It was here that he picked up the woman's friend. And it would be her last ride. The 23-year-old prostitute named Kelly Marie Hammond was the victim. She was left naked and had been strangled to death. When she was found, her body was still warm, leading police to believe that they had just missed the killer.
That's so sad.
But he did something he hadn't done before. He left a witness.
Exactly.
And you know what's really sad? And one of the things that when I was reading this, she was screaming at her friend not to get in the van and that her friend couldn't hear her, not to get in the car.
Oh,
could you imagine?
Heartbreaking. So, I'm surprised he left a witness. I'm surprised he went.
He was just getting brave. I mean, that was number 16. That was
victim number 16
that we know about. Because
right.
So the woman who jumped out of the van was able to create a very complete composite sketch of the suspect and his vehicle. Investigators quickly issued an APB, which stands for?
All-Point Bulletin.
Very good. And within hours, newspapers and television stations were broadcasting the killer's likeness. His reign of terror was coming to an end, but he wasn't quite finished yet.
Bastard.
On September 13th, 1991, the body of 30-year-old Catherine McDonald, a known drug user and prostitute, was found near a building site in Tuscany. At first, investigators thought the murder might be unrelated to the others because the victim was black, and all the victims up to this point were white.
Huh.
But guess what? There's a reason. When they looked closer, they saw something that changed their mind. McDonald's right breast was removed, like Cheryl Coker's. But unlike Coker's, it was nowhere to be found. He took it.
Ooh.
After discussing the murder amongst themselves, it came out that a psychologist was interviewed on a local news station, news channel. Mm-hmm. And they said that the killer was probably a white male who preyed exclusively on white women.
Right, which is normally what happens.
So hence, the purpose of McDonald's murder was to show everybody who was in charge. He purposely took a black woman. The victim toll is about to hit number 18.
Lord,
man was driving along when he spotted what he thought was what?
A mannequin.
A mannequin.
It's never a mannequin.
It's never a mannequin. But on closer inspection, he knew it was a dead body. It was on October 30th, 1991. The victim was identified as 35-year-old Delilah Zamora Wallace, a prostitute and drug addict and mother of five. Her cause of death was asphyxiation. The killer was now claiming one victim per month, and police were pulling their hair out.
Oh, I bet.
Obviously.
And can you imagine the community?
2 days before Christmas 1991, Eleanor Caceres' naked body was found near Victoria Avenue, just down the street from the Riverside Police Station. Talk about taunting. The 39-year-old drug addict and prostitute had been strangled and her right breast was missing. The proximity of the body to the police station angered them greatly.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine.
And they were convinced that the killer purposely placed her there to make them, you know, look stupid or
just to piss them off.
Yeah, just to
play with them. Cat and mouse type thing.
But it's all about to come to an end, thank goodness.
Good.
And I love, like, when these killers are just so bad. They're just so bad. They're so bad. And then they do something stupid and get caught, right?
Or then once they're caught, they cry.
Baby. Officer Frank Orta was patrolling University Avenue during the evening of January 9th, 1991, when something caught his eye. A van pulled into view, and it matched the description of the APB.
Mm.
The van made an illegal U-turn. That is all the officer needed. Orta flashed his lights and siren, and he pulled over. He quickly, quickly called for backup.
Of course. He's no dummy.
Mm-hmm.
Mama didn't raise no dummy.
The driver, a man by the name of William Suff, that's S-U-F-F, appeared to be polite, but his driver's license was suspended. His vehicle registration was expired.
Hmm, good reason to arrest him.
The suspect was then transported to the Riverside Police Station for questioning. Detective Christiana Kears and John Davis began questioning the suspect. The interrogation lasted for hours and Self repeatedly denied any involvement in the murders. Investigators were going to need evidence to gain a conviction without a confession. Their job would obviously be harder.
Right.
Police collected blood and hair samples from the suspect and arrested him for suspicion of multiple murder.
Good for that police officer for keeping an eye out. I need a hero.
Hero.
I'm holding out for a hero.
So media, as they often do, started digging into Self's past, but not much was uncovered, except a few vital things. William Lester Self was born on August 20th, 1950 in Torrance, California. According to classmates, Suff was a friendly person and a skillful musician and carefree, but that image soon changed. Apparently, in 1974, Suff, who was then 24, and his former wife were arrested and convicted of beating their two-year-old daughter to death. He was sentenced to 70 years in prison, but earned parole in March 1984 after only serving 10 years.
That is so wrong.
His wife
should have rotted in there.
His wife served a mere 20 months before having her conviction overturned.
No, sorry. That's a travesty.
In 1986, Suff began working as a stock clerk for the county of Riverside. Now, here's irony. I guess, what's the definition of irony? Here it is. He had delivered furniture to the Riverside Task Force headquarters midway through this killing spree.
Right.
It was there, in fact, that he asked to use a phone, and he was on the phone as he was listening to police talk about the murders. Do you believe that?
Unreal. He's got some cojones.
He sure does. Friends of Suff described him as a mild-mannered man who kept to himself and spent his free time writing stories and cookbooks. He loved to cook chili and often entered chili cooking contests. And at least...
No.
Hold on now. Rein it in, girl. Rein it in. Rein it in. And at least one occasion, his chili recipe won him first prize at a local cook-off. On February 28, 1992, Suff was arraigned before Judge Becky Dugan in Division 22 of Riverside Municipal Courthouse. Suff's attorney, Floyd Zergarski, entered a plea of innocent on two of the 19 deaths to which his client was charged.
19.
After hearing arguments from both sides, Judge Dugan ruled that there was enough evidence to send the case to trial. Well, I would hope so. William Suff's trial began on March 25, 1995, before Judge W. Charles Morgan in the Riverside Hall of Justice. Prosecutor Paul E. Zellerbach chose to go first and explain to the jury that detectives had enough evidence to convict Suff to the murders of 13 women. And he described Suff as a violent sexual sadist who enjoyed torturing and murdering women.
I'm glad you said women, because he would have said sex workers or prostitutes. That's just what they did. That's not who they were. They were women. He murdered women.
Suff's two lawyers, Randolph K. Driggs, a former prosecutor who had actually worked with Zellerbach, and Frank S. Peasley, described Suff as an easygoing man who was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Oh, yeah.
In the wrong place at the wrong time 19 times.
At least.
19 plus. The most powerful testimony came from the Department of Justice criminologist and hair and fiber expert, Faye Springer.
That's a lot of words to
say
right
there. Sure is. And I did it pretty good, didn't I?
You did.
Springer testified that microscopic samples of hair found at two of the murder scenes matched Suff's own hairs.
Yay.
And good. That fibers from a pillow and a blanket and a sleeping bag found inside Suff's van were similar to those discovered at Kim Lytle and Christina Leal scenes.
Wow.
Now, the victim that jumped out of the van testified uh-huh. that he had a red sleeping bag in the back of his car. In addition, Springer said that a towel that covered Lytle's naked body contained two fibers similar to the floor carpeting in Suff's vehicle. Other fibers were found on Suff's car seat matched that of a t-shirt and sock found on Leal's body, proving they were in the car. As we know in this case, it was the evidence that led to his conviction, but there were some other questions. His tire tracks matched those tread marks left at the murder scenes. His shoes matched impressions left in the dirt, and there was a rope found in his van. Prosecutor Zellerbach built his case on microscopic evidence, the testimony of one woman who survived an assault and another who had jumped out of Suff's car, and statements from Suff's wife. But throughout the presentation of the case, Zellerbach hammered on the violence allegedly displayed by Suff, whom he described as, and I love this quote, like a spider with his web, weaving it, waiting for the insect or the fly, or in this case, a prostitute, to enter into his world, his van, end quote. That really sums it up, too, doesn't it?
It does.
Suff preyed on prostitutes. He lured the women by offering them $20 in exchange for sex.
$20.
An interesting note here, because I was thinking about this morning. One of these prostitutes that he picked up was hungry, so he took her through a drive-thru and paid for her meal. But then he told her he was only going to give her $10 for sex instead of $20. But here's the thing. He's going to kill her and get the money back anyway, you cheap SOB. Like, seriously? My God, you know you're going to kill her. So what, you're sitting there arguing about money? And so she was mad and he killed her. The killing started in 1986 and ended in December 1991. Suff would lure women into his vehicle, kill them by strangulation or stabbing, and then purposely, carefully pose their bodies in lewd offensive positions in fields, citrus orchards, or even by a garbage dumpster.
Or bowling alley.
Suff's wife, Cheryl, who was, by the way, 18, testified that one night he told her he had to go present a earthquake preparation talk in Temecula, and she should not wait up for him. Then she said he had never put on an earthquake show in his life. He'd never done a talk like that. He didn't.
And she didn't realize it?
A woman was killed that night. Another night, she said, he returned home with scratches on his face. Now, according to testimony, Suff offered clothing from one of his victims to a friend. After his arrest, investigators found in the vehicle's glove box a traffic citation of one of his victims. It was a trophy,
obviously, yeah.
At least two women who might otherwise have been victims, one who escaped a strangling hold and the other one that fled from the vehicle, were questioned and identified Suff in a group of mugshots.
Good.
It was pretty obvious. One witness testified that she was working the streets of Elsinore in January 1989 when a man she later identified as Suff picked her up. At her suggestion, they went to an empty house nearby where the power had been turned off. But when he grabbed her throat, she fought him off and ran. She reported the assault 2 weeks later after learning a friend of hers had been murdered. Prosecutor Zellerbach noted that beside one of the victim's bodies, investigators found grapefruit peelings. Talked about that earlier.
Uh-huh.
Zellerbach said, quote, it's significant to me because someone who had just brutally murdered another human being could sit there and pick a grapefruit off a tree, peel it, and eat it. This dead victim bleeding, lying on the ground next to him. That is indicative to me of a human being who doesn't have a conscience. Cold, calculating, just a way of life, another dead body, another conquest, another success, another rush, and now he's going to sit back and eat a grapefruit and enjoy it, end quote. After 54 days of testimony and 4 days of deliberation, the jury found Seth guilty on 12 of the 13 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of attempted murder, although his victim count is believed to be as high as 22.
No way.
I bet it's way higher than that.
I bet you it's way higher.
The jury also found Seth guilty of multiple murder, use of a deadly weapon, and lying in wait. The following day, August 17th, 1995, after only 10 minutes of deliberating, he was given the death sentence. Today, he's on death row at San Quentin, still, where he is awaiting execution. He is 71 years old. He continues to maintain his innocence and claims that police used him as a scapegoat.
Oh, of course they did.
Of course they did.
He's never guilty.
Now, two things here. October 26, 1991, Self's three-month-old daughter with that new wife that was...
The 18-year-old.
The baby. Mm-hmm. She was removed from the home by the San Fernando Valley County authorities because she had suffered serious injuries in the home.
You don't say.
And finally, let me leave you with this. Now, this is just a rumor, but I found it in several locations, several spots, as I was researching this. It has been said that Self used two of the victim's breasts in the chilies he prepared.
I knew it.
For the Riverside County employees' annual picnic. The information has never been confirmed.
Oh, like that would ever get out. Could you imagine?
No.
I'm never going to eat at a work function again. That's awful.
All right.
What a freak.
Freaky freak, right?
Jeez.
So I just don't, like, how does that even, I don't, what? The other thing that I didn't mention in here is that show that I like, Real Detectives.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Creed, one of the orchards in which one of the bodies were found, I think it was victim number 16, that was actually his grandparents' land, and he had played on that land, so it, like, took a toll on him. So
wow.
Watch the show. It's good. Anyway, Jen, that's it. What else
that
you
was,
got?
That was interesting. I don't think I know about him. Great episode.
Tell the people where they can find us.
You can find us on Twitter. Our handle is at Our True Crime Pod. I love to talk to people, give us a shout out, say hello, tell me your dog's name. Another place you can find us.
Facebook, Our True Crime Podcast at gmail.com.
Mm-hmm. We have a blog that we always fail to update, but you can still go on there. It's ourtruecrimepodcast.com.
That's about it.
I think that's
make sure
about
you
it.
Tune in to all the good places where you get your podcasts.
Podbean, Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, even YouTube. You can even find our episodes on our blog page. That's it.
So remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya.
I'm leaving my headset, my headphones here. Is that okay?
No, you got to take them home. Just like one of those one-night stands. I forgot. I'm going to have to come back because I forgot my headphones.
The autopsy? Yeah.
State
first
one.
Paragraph is always the most important.
Is it?
It is. For me, it is.
Because you're just a struggler.
Just a struggler. All right, ready?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going ahead. It was on December 11th. Albuquerque, New York. Whoop.
That's a lot of math, but I'd figure out that there was a lot of people.
On here? Was that how
I
say
it? I don't know.
Whatever.
Just go with
we'll
Angel.
Go with Angel. See, is this too graphic, you think?
No.
As a result of asphyxiation, detective...
He's got some cojones.
He sure does. Friends of Seth...
Should be cut off.
Tim is a mild manner...
So everybody out there out in podcast land, how you doing? You can call us at 1-800. I don't know, Rupert, remember how you used to yell at me about all that kind of stuff?
I know, but it's because I put it in here, but I put it in the wrong spot, so I'm going to find it.